Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. Back on October 19th, the Wisconsin Network for Peace and Justice, that's WNPJ.org on the web, held their 33rd annual Fall Assembly at the Madison Friends Meeting House, featuring three powerful speakers and several other activities. Fortunately, the event was recorded on video, and we're sharing the speeches here today on Spirit in Action. And you can also watch videos of the speakers on the WNPJ.org website. In our broadcast version, we'll only have two of the three speakers, but the podcast version, available via NordenSpiritRadio.org, will have all of them, sharing on a range of peace and justice topics. First up, only in the uncut version, is the inspirational and talented Elena Terry, member of the Ho-Chunk tribe, food sovereignty advocate and activist, and founder of Wild Berries. Also presenting is Ellen Chavoya, outreach chair of the Milwaukee Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, and will conclude with Professor Samer Alatoot, a Palestinian-American who participated in the encampment at UW-Madison. It'll be well worth your time to check out more about this event and the Wisconsin Network for Peace and Justice Organization at WNPJ.org. We'll head now to the WNPJ 2024 Fall Assembly for some amazing speakers. Next up is Ellen Chavoya, introduced by Dina Eccles for the WNPJ board.
So I get the opportunity to welcome another dear friend and our second guest, Ellen Chavoya. Ellen is the outreach chair of the Milwaukee Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression and the secretary of the National Alliance. Ellen organizes for the national liberation of oppressed people in Milwaukee, especially those impacted by police crimes. He dedicates his energy to being with the people of Milwaukee and responding to the issues that matter most to them, such as Palestinian liberation and putting an end to police crimes. Over the past year, I have served with Ellen on the Wisconsin Coalition for Justice in Palestine. It's been an incredible honor, and I really thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much, Dina, for inviting me. I'm very grateful to have been given this opportunity and grateful for having met Dina over this past year around Palestinian solidarity work, and to have been trusted to be invited to speak to something like this today. So I'm very grateful for that. I'll explain a little bit of who I am, the work we do in Milwaukee Alliance, and how it ties to today's themes of, you know, ending militarism, that culture, that environment, and transitioning, right, working towards peace and environmental justice as well, right, and environmental sustainability, and how the work of the Milwaukee Alliance ties to that. So I'm born and raised in Milwaukee. I'm a Chicano. My parents came from Mexico shortly before I was born. And so I grew up in Milwaukee. I grew up in what is called the South Side of Milwaukee, which is where it's predominantly Mexican, working class background these days. From when I was born, there used to be a lot of the Polish neighborhood. But before then, right, the histories of the different nations who lived there, right, in Milwaukee, right, the Potawatomi, there were the Ho-Chunk, the Menominee, and many more. And so it's just, you know, the more I grew up in my city, I come to, you know, it has a lot of issues, as I'll get into some of them around primarily policing. But it's definitely a city that I feel rooted in, that I love, that despite all of those things that are difficult to accept, I embrace and recognize my role and responsibility to work towards a brighter future, right? And that's really what drew me back to organizing. I had started my doctoral program in philosophy, and I had transitioned over to, for the first time in my life, moving away from Milwaukee to Chicago because I was at Northwestern. But then a little something, some of you might recognize it as COVID happened. And I was like, oh, everything's virtual now. So I came back to Milwaukee at around March since everything was virtual. But then around that time, you know, things started to boil a bit more and more. And then May of 2020 happened with the brutal killing of George Floyd. In Milwaukee, things really picked up, a lot of the work picked up, and a lot of the organizing, there was a lot of energy, as we all remember. And so I met a group of people there who were the Milwaukee Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. And there was a small group of people, but very committed. And that's something that stood out to me, the commitment that people have, right? Oftentimes people come into the organizing space thinking it's like a cool fad or something, but they lack that sort of commitment to being with one another, to going through the boring, mundane aspects of organizing in order to be successful at doing the big things that people seem to think that's all organizing is about, right? But that's just a small fraction. And so I came to them and I started organizing with them. And then I started learning about the organization. So I've been with them since 2020. Like I said, the organization itself was refounded in 2019 as the National Alliance, and the Milwaukee chapter being one of the original chapters from way back in 1973, which is when it was first founded as a National Alliance. It was founded shortly after the struggle to free Angela Davis and the Black Panthers involved in her case. You know, many of you may remember that case where, you know, she was imprisoned and there was a national and international struggle to free her and those, you know, involved in her case. And so out of that, there was a lot of a recognition that there was a lot more work to be done to free a lot of the political prisoners. And to this day, you know, the United States has so many political prisoners. You know, you can just look at Leonard Peltier, right? I think he's the longest incarcerated political prisoner we have in this country. People like Mumma Abdul-Jabbar, so many folks like that. And so the Milwaukee Alliance, or the National Alliance, really worked on that, but it also started working towards questions around policing, right? The demand that we have is the demand called community control of the police, where the people form democratically elected councils to answer questions about policing themselves, of who polices their neighborhoods, if they want police in their neighborhoods, ability to control the budget, which I'll get into a little bit of how the budgets really reflect, I think, the national budget of this country, which is trillions and trillions, right, for war and occupation. We see that play in our cities where it's hundreds of millions going towards policing and towards this sort of, you know, what they call like wars on crime, wars on drugs, or what we consider wars on poor and oppressed peoples. So this, you know, democratically elected body would be able to hold police accountable themselves, right? But that requires a tremendous amount of political power, of economic power, of just community power, right? That we, unfortunately, it's been so devastated in our communities, right? Like how much, you know, our cities, our neighborhoods have been dismantled over many, many years of just vicious repression, right? From, you can see it in how our schools have been decimated. This wasn't just through Act 10, right? But it's something that's happened for many decades. How it is that our infrastructure has just gone, like, become terrible. A lot of the jobs, I know I saw Steve in the audience, you know, I'm a proud union member with Steve and AFD 212, but the jobs in Milwaukee have all gone away, right? But what we see, all of those resources that are life-affirming resources in our communities, it's a relationship there of, as those get underfunded. It started primarily around the 70s in Milwaukee and other major cities. In the 70s, when the funding for those goes down, the funding for policing goes up. So then it becomes a society that's built on creating this system of quote-unquote safety through policing rather than safety through these life-affirming institutions that we so desperately need, that we're seeing the ramifications of it today, right, 50 years later, of there's food deserts all around us. I know the previous speaker spoke about the importance of nourishment that comes from healthy food, that comes from healthy education, that comes from healthy homes. And so a lot of that is intertwined with how it is that policing works here, just through the economic sense. So that's a little bit of how our work, you know, even though it's around policing, it really ties, we have to understand it, how linked it is to all of these other struggles that we have. And so, like I said, we view the problem of militarism in the policing. This shows up in many ways. I already said, right, a little bit about how the budget, the U.S. society is one that views everyone as an enemy. And that's something that was embedded from the very beginning, right? They come in as they expanded westward. All the indigenous peoples were viewed as enemies. My people, right, the Chicanos, the Mexicans, they were viewed as enemies in that Mexican-American war. And that resulted in the annexation of the entire Southwest region, which is where the Chicanos are from, right? And so there's that. And you see that policing has its links to those ways of understanding society and what, you know, this sort of civilization that we have to protect from these vicious groups of people. And that gets embedded today, right? You hear the same narratives of how it is that the police view themselves as this thin blue line between civilization and something else, right? They might not call it barbarism as they once did, but they depict it as such, right? They say all these criminals, that's the next term that they use today, right? To criminalize all the populations. And we know who they criminalize. They criminalize Black, Brown, Indigenous, and poor people. And so they say, oh, it's our job to protect and serve and to keep people safe. And so they really view themselves as like an army, right, of protectors. But really, it's an army of oppressors that they've done, right? And so that's something that is embedded in, I would say, in militarism. You see it also intertwined materially. We've seen it. There's this thing called Operation Legend, by which local law enforcement agencies can access and are provided with military-grade equipment. I remember vividly in 2020, the small municipality right next to Milwaukee called Wauwatosa, they had tanks. And tanks pointed at residents, right? We were marching for justice for people that were killed by the same police officer from Wauwatosa. He had killed 3 people in Wauwatosa in a span of like 5 years, I think. And we were marching right in solidarity with the families and people decrying this killing. And they had tanks. Where did those tanks come from? How do you explain that a small municipality like that has a multi-million dollar tank with them, right? And not to account for all of the other arsenal and equipment they have. So something like Operation Legend shows how policing these technologies that they have, that they deploy in their wars that they fund, right? Whether it's, you know, in the Middle East, whether it was in Afghanistan and Iraq, they're bringing them back home, right? So it's this proverbial like chickens coming home to roost. And we're finding it in our place and how they view the people who are organizing, people like us in the Milwaukee Alliance. Like I said, they had tanks pointed at us and all this equipment. So that's one aspect. And the other one that addresses, I think, more importantly today, the connections with who they train with. Law enforcement oftentimes goes and gets training with groups like the Israeli occupation forces. And we see those technologies. We must never forget how it is that Derek Chauvin, who knelt on George Floyd's neck for so many minutes, that style of kneeling on someone, that was the same style and tactics used by the Israelis on Palestinians. And he learned it from them. And so showing that and understanding those material links is really important for us. And that's why in the Milwaukee Alliance and the National Alliance, the question of Palestine has been so, so crucial. It's not just to put an end to it, but also because it's so linked to how it is that policing targets Black, Brown, Indigenous, and poor people in this country. And so understanding how it is that if we're really going to organize putting an end to police killing people in our neighborhoods, we must also see it as important for putting an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestine, to putting an end to the occupations everywhere that we see, right? We can see it in Congo, in Sudan, and other countries, in Latin America and the Caribbean, and a lot of other countries where there's that military force presence in occupying and destabilizing communities, because we view the police doing that in the local scale on us. And so that's a little bit of how we view these problems. But more importantly, the reason why we understand it in those ways is because it gives us a path forward and understands our organizing in such a powerful way. We know that in order for us to do this work well, of holding the police accountable, of fighting for transparency, we need a very solid organization. And we need an organization that's capable of doing this. And that comes from people who are committed to community and people committed to stepping away from the individualism that we often are told is what's important in a society. So it really is to organize, it's a labor of love. You can't do this if you don't have love for one another or love for your communities. Without that, it's, you know, you can't really go far. You get easily burned out if you think it's only on you as an individual. We're going to go through rough moments. I mean, it's really difficult. Like me as the outreach chair, it's often my responsibility to talk with families who have lost loved ones to police violence. And it's heart-wrenching. It's devastating. And so there's times where I can feel myself slowly breaking down, just taking on all of that, that you see, that you witness, that you hear about. But if it wasn't for my friends and my comrades who I organize with, and if I know I can lean on them, knowing that, I know that I can keep going because I have people I can lean on, and vice versa, the people can lean on me, and I know that I have to show up for them in those ways. So it's really, that's a little of how we really organize in the Milwaukee Alliance of this, even though it's, we've grown considerably since 2020, but it's still, you know, a smaller group compared to other big organizations of people who really are solid in those ways. Even though it's the quantity is not there, the quality, I would say, is definitely there that keeps us going. And more importantly, it allows us to work with these families. That's something that I've learned so much over the years of how families are going through what is just such a difficult moment, such a challenging, horrifying moment of they just lost a loved one to a police shooting, that they're able to take that pain and suffering and channel it towards something productive. If it wasn't for, you know, the families of people like Dontre Hamilton, who was killed in 2014 by Milwaukee police, family of Alvin Cole, who was killed in 2020, and the families of these people that came together with us and told us, look, we want to know what happened to our loved ones, and we need policy around transparency, around footage release. If it wasn't for them being able to come with us and help us drive those things forward, we would not have been able to push for that policy, which is now in place in Milwaukee, where footage has to be released of critical incidents involving police. It's not the end-all be-all, right? It won't stop police killings, but there is an element of transparency that wasn't there without these families becoming fighters for justice amidst those difficult moments. So I know if they can do it, I know I can do it, right? Like, what's fascinating, it's often mothers and sisters who end up doing it because the fathers or the other male figures are oftentimes also taken away from the communities through incarceration. And so we're oftentimes fighting with the families that are, you know, these are usually the mothers, we call them the mothers of the movement, who come together with us. And it's been honestly an honor working with them closely to continue to do that. And so that's something we're really working towards, of working with them, because they, what's beautiful is seeing how they understand their case, even as an individual case, they view it as connected to so much else. They say, even though I can't necessarily get justice for my son or my child, I know that by pushing for these changes, it will be a form of justice because I want to prevent other ones from happening. So there's also that future orientation they have of they want to put an end to this in the future. And though it might not directly impact them anymore due to their conditions, they care so deeply for this. And that's really why we continue to do it. So it's a long work in progress. We're fighting for this accountability from law enforcement. We want that community control where people can determine their own fates. We don't want that military style intervention in our communities, just how we fight for the Palestinian struggle, where we want the Palestinians to be liberated to determine their future and their understanding. We want our communities to be able to define themselves in their own image, in their own understanding, communities of care, communities of love, communities that say, hey, those resources that are coming to our city, we want them to build beautiful gardens. We want them to build beautiful educational spaces, whether it's a much better school than what they have and whatnot, right? Like if you talk to people in our community, that's what they want. And our understanding, to close, the current work we do around whether it's the police or the county jail, and putting an end to those killings, to that violence that is done to our communities, is really not just to put an end to it, but to create a future in which we can then allow our communities to flourish. And that's also linked to putting an end to how it is that those connections, drying up, breaking the chain of the connection between policing and the military interventions abroad. So it's going to require a lot, but it's something that we're very passionate about and we're going to continue fighting for in the Milwaukee Alliance. So again, thank you all so much for listening to me and for inviting me to speak.
Alan Chavoya of the Milwaukee Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression spoke to the annual Fall Assembly of the Wisconsin Network for Peace and Justice held on October 19th. But you get to hear him today for Spirit in Action. Our website is northernspiritradio.org, which can be very helpful should you wish to track down the WNPJ.org website, or that of Alan and the other two speakers of the day. And not only them, but all of the Spirit in Action and Song of the Soul guests of the past 19 and a half years. Just visit northernspiritradio.org and track them down. That's a lot of inspirational and talented guests shared with some 35 community radio stations across the nation and about 15 or 20 podcast sites. Come to northernspiritradio.org and help us out by posting a comment, promoting us at your local community radio station, or sharing a link with friends. You can also help us out with a donation, which has been really important in these past couple months. We go on because of your help. We head back now to the final segment of the WNPJ Assembly, and the WNPJ Board Secretary, Erica Bach, will be introducing Samer Alatut and giving him their Peacemaker of the Year Award. Over to Erica.
Professor Alatute is at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And as we know, UW-Madison has a long history of civil unrest, student uprising, speaking truth to power and using that power for good. Also, as an institution and as a entity of the state, we know that the universities around our area are not without fail and certainly need to be held accountable. So this is as Erica, not as WNPJ or the professor, but I would like to encourage you to please reach out to your institutions where you might be an alum. Please reach out to the organizations that you know would be supportive of a boycott, divestment, or sanctions. Please reach out within the scope of your spheres of influence and your physical and emotional capabilities to be able to say, no more war, no more genocide, no more oppression. One of the things that, a little emotional on that one. Hard not to be, right? One of the things that I would like to just highlight here, and forgive me, I'm trying to still be a millennial by using my phone here, far removed. but one of the things that I wanted to just point out was something that I saw on the professor's Twitter. And that is to say that the people who are currently fighting for their lives in Palestine are the children and grandchildren of the people who greatly were impacted in 1948, in 1978, and 7 years ago, and 7 days ago, and today. And so it's important to remember that what we're seeing, not only in Gaza, what we're seeing in the Democratic Republic of Congo, what we're seeing here on the streets of Madison, Milwaukee, Green Bay, we are all interconnected. What we're seeing on lands that were not ceded treaties in indigenous and native communities, we're seeing that there's this connection that runs through us, which is that a dictator is never as powerful as they think they are. And the people are always stronger than they think they are. So we have a wide swath across the state, across this country, and across this world. And Professor Alatute has done an amazing job of recognizing that both through his scholarship at the UW in agroecology, I believe it's called. Okay, I'm going to have him tell you correctly so I don't misrepresent. But the sustainability, land without borders, what it means to have power in terms of water and resources and how we share that for our greater good. And so I have the distinct honor, as I mentioned, to present this award. And this award comes by way of Mary Kay Baum. Mary Kay is a longstanding member, as many of you know, of WNPJ and a former educator herself. Also very involved in politics to bring those voices of the unheard. As we've heard, a riot is the language of the oppressed. And one of the things that, to be very clear, we're seeing from the students' encampments is not a riot. It is a loud and clear call for the right to return. It is a loud and clear call for divestments. Why are universities being involved in the funding of a military in the first place? Right? It's a call to question ourselves about our choices in consumerism and where our money is actually a moral compass. It's a statement about our values. And so with that, I want to just call attention very briefly to the artwork that Mary Kay has presented because it suits the professor so perfectly. So Professor, this is a piece of art from Mary Kay Baum. This is the Great Blue Heron. Mary Kay is an avid photographer and while you have the sandpiper in Palestine, we have many different birds here as well in the Americas, plural. So we actually have something in common between the two species. And this great blue heron does not always come back to the same nest, but it always comes back to the same rookery. So for example, the freshmen this year will be sophomores next year. The seniors this year will go on into the world. And so Professor here continues to come back to the rookery, although the nests may be different each year. And what I witnessed in that encampment was a moment of solidarity where an elder was providing for the young. And we are so honored. Excuse me, just one more moment here. Thank you so much. Oh, likewise. What I would like to just say is that we need individuals like our elders and like our educators to continue to protect our young people, to guide them, to think critically, to examine another world as possible. And so with this, Professor, we honor from your new home in Wisconsin, not so new anymore, but as opposed to Palestine, please know that there is a connection both across nature and across nurture. We are so grateful for all that you do, not only for our students, but for our community and for our world. So please join me in thanking Professor Asal Meretut. And now we have an opportunity to hear from the honoree himself. I will turn this over now to Professor Samara Toth.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for an amazing first. I mean, my honor and my privilege to be here with Elena and Alan, amazing people. The whole time that when they were talking, I was thinking they should be the ones who receive the Peacemaker Award. This is not just saying it, and it's not just a frivolous kind of credit to them, but I think most of us, probably all of us here, it speaks to how we think of ourselves and the others around us, how we think that we are all connected, that we probably are not as good as others think that we are, and that there are so many who are much better than we are. Like, for example, Elena and Alan, they are amazing, and you're all amazing. So thank you so much for this honor. And, you know, like I said, I don't think of myself as deserving of it, but I love the fact that you decided to give it to me. I am proud of it personally, but at the same time, I'm proud of it because it's such a powerful statement that the Wisconsin Network of Peace and Justice is saying that there are a number of things that are connected, that dissent and protest are approaches to peace, that they deserve acknowledgement, but also that I am not only Palestinian, not only American, but now I made it to Wisconsinite. I am a Wisconsin person, and I am, the layers of identity are very thinly developed into each other and mixed together and make us all the people that we are or the communities we are. So I'm honored, and I think that in a way, I mean, I think of it as really a testament to the people who have been working all this year, probably all of us. I mean, it comes under circumstances that none of us would like happened or have happened. We probably will gladly, all of us, let go of the, I mean, I wouldn't let go of the piece of art, amazing one, but we would probably let go of any award. Just give us one little child in Gaza back to life, or giving us just one arm of a child who lost it, right? We'll give everything back, all of this. So thank you so much. And all the conversation from Elena and Alan, I mean, they said so many things that I would have said too. And it shows that the connections of oppression, the circumstances of oppression and discipline and policing are very much general, right? They are global kind of forces that we need to pay attention to them as global forces, and they are connected. But I thought of what to say today, and initially I was like, okay, I'm going to talk about something academic. No, no way, right? I mean, I cannot even think academically anymore since the beginning of this atrocious war. So what I thought to do is to give you a little bit about myself, my kind of biography, if you will, and then to turn into, like, to end with some about what happened last year and how we came together and how everything that has happened unfolded. In terms of biography, in 1967, when the war in the West Bank and Gaza, of course, the war happened in 1948. And I mean, I assume, I wish we could give you maps to show you, but there are, 1948 comes in, Palestinians, most of them are displaced from what came to be known Israel later on. And the Palestinians became refugees, many of them. I was not. I was born in Nablus, which is in the West Bank. My family goes back to the 1400s, at least that's the recorded history. Our house in Nablus, for example, it's called like Alatut Quarters, which has been built in 1804. So it's just a little younger than the U.S. itself. So I wake up in 1967, I was a child, and there is a possible war. Not yet a war, but there is a possible war. We start trying to figure out how are we going whenever there is an, you know, a sirens for an attack. What do? We go to the shelters, but then which kid will carry what thing? I was entrusted, I don't know why, with my mother's gold and the papers of the family. My older sister was entrusted of carrying my brother, who was 2 years old. My mother was entrusted with something else, and my other sister was entrusted with carrying food, and we will run to the shelter, and we will come out of the shelter depending on the day. And then one day, we're in the shelter, and there is a woman that comes into the shelter and says, "Hey, we should celebrate. The Syrian army and the Iraqi army are coming in from the east. So we're fine. Israel lost the war." Then 3 hours later, and everybody, of course, is crazily happy. We're not under occupation. But then 3 hours later, another one comes in and says, "Those were Israeli soldiers. This time they came from the east so that we don't move," right? They didn't want us to move at that point or be displaced at that very particular moment. And so we were under occupation. When I became 11 years old, I'll tell you a story about how activism starts, right? I mean, so many people talk about how there are adults that are totally out of it, right? They are evil terrorists. They brainwash the kids, etc. Now, I was living with my mother and father and my two sisters and brother, and I was 11 years old, but we saw everything every single day. We will walk to the streets. I will walk to the school on the street, and I will be stopped. I was like this, right? 8, 9, 10. I mean, we will be stopped on our way to school. We will be put against the wall. We will be hit. Our dignities were always subject to brutal performance by the military forces. And we saw them kicking our fathers, our uncles, our every single day. Every single day there are curfews, there are searches and seizures, right? And there is killing, there is shooting, there is whatever it is. But at 11, I mean, after watching all this, my older sister, who is 12 or 13, maybe she's 1.5 years older than I am, but I was 11 at the time. And so we decided that we have to do something, because every single person has an inner, a very profound force for liberty and for freedom and for having the possibility of a free life. And so we decided we had to do something. And so we formed a party. We didn't have any relationships with anyone. We didn't have any relationships with political activists. We had nothing. Like, she's 12 and I'm 11, right? I mean, we don't even go outside the house. Our initial understanding of the world comes from what? Comes from Jewish intellectuals that we read really heavily, even at that young age. We read literature, Russian, American, Latin American, any number of things, right? Palestinians, right? And so there was a huge commitment, a huge love, a huge understanding of the need for liberty, the need for freedom. And so we made a party. We called it, I mean, don't react too badly for the violent title of the party. The party was the Palestinian Bloody Resistance Party for the Liberation of Palestine. And what we did is we distributed, my sister and her friend who was with us, we wrote some leaflets. I took them to distribute them. They wrote them because we were really smart, right? We knew that if I'm caught while I'm distributing them by the Israeli forces, then they will make me write it. And so that they don't know it's me, I didn't write it. Then anyway, my sister and her friend wrote it, and I distributed them. But where would an 11-year-old really think of distributing leaflets like that, that's calling for the freedom of Palestine? In the neighborhood. So around us, in the building, in our own building, in the stores, just putting them here and there. So anyway, to make the story shorter, a neighbor of ours who was like about 90 years old was holding this leaflet that I gave him that we put in his house, and he was really scared. So I pretended not to know anything, and I pulled it out of his hand. It tore a little bit. But what did he do? Because he was really scared, he went to the police and told them, hey, look, we received this. And that was in the beginning of occupation, of course. People are really scared. This guy was actually a refugee from Jaffa. And so it makes sense that he will be scared. But the first question they asked him, why is it torn? And the thing he said, it's our neighbor kid, right? He pulled it to read it for me. Now, the problem is that the police, of course, probably knew exactly how old the person who wrote those things are, right? So if I'm 11 years old, then it makes sense to bring this 11 years old. And that was my first direct interaction with police violence. I was 11. They took me to the interrogation center. They came to the house with three cars or jeeps, right? And they took me and they took my mother. So they told her, follow us, like, because I'm 11 years old. And so they took me to this interrogation center where they hit me, kicked me, put me in a chair, like a small like chair in the middle of a room. And there were like five of them and, you know, asking me stuff like that. And then they asked me to write the same words. And of course, I didn't write it. So I was freed for that. But I spent 3 hours under interrogation and police violence. And I couldn't confess, because if I confess, I will have to tell on my sister, for example, right? And I have to tell on my sister's friend. So I kept my mouth shut. What happens next is that when they released me 3 hours later with my mother, is that I spent probably about 2 weeks bedridden with a temperature of like more than 104, 105, right? And it's because I am traumatized. Before we made our party, I was traumatized by occupation. And before occupation, I was traumatized by the stories of all these refugees that I know and all of these stories about 1948 and about camps and refugee camps and needs and poverty and any number of things, right? And killing and torture. And then, of course, I started the road that brings me to here. This is where the transitions that have happened in my life from 1971 until now have been constantly, until I came to the US, every single move I did in my life was controlled by others. You have no idea how much our lives are controlled. Like, for example, my identity card or my ID or my papers, who am I? What kind of passport do I have? Changed like five times, not because I wanted, but because of political calculations in the area. But every single time that changes, you are awake at night. You don't know what happens. You're worried. Your mother is worried. Your parents are worried. Everybody is worried. Are we going to stay here? Are we going to move? What are we going to do? Where are we going to go? And every single time I had to move under these pressures. Never had I decided to move to somewhere on my own, even coming to the U.S., was because my passport is ending. I had a Jordanian passport. The Jordanians have separated us from them, the West Bankers, right? Because we were under them anyway. It's a long history and long story. But they separated and they said, okay, you're on your own. Now my passport is about to end. Where am I going to go? I have to go back to Palestine, but I couldn't really because of politically, I couldn't. I just had a lot of whatever issues. And then where do I go? So I chose the US and I had a visa, visit visa. I had to come here. I went through struggles and struggles in order to go to a university and then to go to the PhD. What I'm saying is that throughout all of this, we had to create our own paths, but those paths were unfair. It was an unfair, in my case, 60 years, right, of life, but in other people's lives, 90 years. And how long more? How long? What will happen in the future? What's happening with the kids now? Anyway, this is too much focus on me, and I didn't mean it to be that long, but I want to bring you back to Gaza. When Gaza initially happened, I was dormant. And what I mean by dormant, I was tired. I've been fighting big fights. I've been traveling a lot, traveling as in life, not from place to place. The trauma was really deep. And I somehow kind of stopped this activism, right? The constant one, where I will march for Vieques, for example, or where I will march for people of color anywhere. And I did that all the time until like recently. And then I decided I need space. And Gaza happened. Before Gaza happened, a number of Zionist organizations have attacked me constantly. And even though I was dormant, I mean, I wasn't doing anything. And they still attacked me because probably a good Palestinian, like they say, I mean, a number of them said that, is a dead Palestinian, right? A number of Israeli officials, even in government now, that's what they say. Like a good Palestinian is a Palestinian that does not exist. So for me, when it happened, and my wife is here, Stacey, what happened is that I was about to lose it, like literally. I mean, I was awake all time, news from news to news. And then I decided, you know what? I need to do something. I have to do something. I was almost like a, like in a, unable to focus on anything, like going crazy. So I decided, you know what? I'm going to go to the Capitol and I'm going to go on hunger strike. I got my kids down, 13 and 16, with my wife. And I said, you know what? If I die, don't worry. I am committed to this. And I was literally, I am now literally willing to die. I don't have any problem. If they send those drones now and shoot me because I'm speaking, that's fine. And I tell my kids now, don't worry about me, right? I want you to be strong. I don't even want you to do anything for Palestine if you don't want to, right? My story ends today in the sense that my commitments to Palestine came anew, exploded, pun not intended. They exploded. I couldn't rest. I was crying. I was depressed. I was not believing the amount of trauma that this genocidal regime is enacting in Gaza. And that was the first month. Imagine now. So I was like, I'm going to do a hunger strike. If I die, whatever. They talked me out of it. But then that's when I started, okay, I have to spend that energy somehow. And I started refocusing everybody in Gaza over everything that I do. That's where the struggle is. Those are the people who need us. Those are the people who should be protected. That's what we are for. And if it's if this moment is that one moment, and I decided that it's the moment that is testing every single one of us, not Palestinians, not Arabs, not Muslims, not Americans, everybody. It's testing our understanding of what a human is, what a future we want, and how do we build that future? What do we do? And so I wasn't even thinking about Palestinians necessarily. I mean, of course, they are the people I love. They are of me and I am of them. They are my kinship. They are my story, my heart. But at the same time, I know that it's about also Israelis, and it's about Jews, and about Muslims, and about Americans, and about everybody else. And so how do you manage to weave a line where you are strongly and without hesitation on the side of the people who are being genocided, and yet at the same time protect yourself from getting into the anti-Semitic, the anti, whatever it is, the anti that you want, right? How do you do that? How do you manage that? So I saw, of course, Palestinians will say, I mean, some of them say anything, right? And I don't blame anyone who says anything, by the way. I mean, I don't really care if they sound anti-Semitic, right? I just don't want it. And I don't want to do it, and I will fight it. But I can understand how people talk. And so for me, it became a huge element in what constitutes our totality. How do we, Palestinians and Israelis, Jews and Muslims and Arabs, I mean, I don't like these distinctions, but how can we bring about a new world in a peaceful way? It doesn't seem possible, but I do think that Palestinians have the right to resist and resist in any shape, way, or form that they think is right. I might not do some of the tactics. I might not choose some of the tactics, but I will stand by them. I will defend them like I did with the students here in encampment, right? I mean, the students did an encampment. I had a part for negotiating some things with the administration, but that didn't get me really anywhere because you saw how I was treated. I don't know how many of you saw my images and in the news, bloodied face and all of that. And I still, what is ironic is that yesterday I had a pre-trial meeting because I did something wrong with the encampment and with defending the students. And here I'm being honored for the same reason. It's amazing. And that should tell you something about it, that the distinction is not between Israeli and Palestinian, even though everybody wants us to believe that, right? And maybe most Israelis are really fascist now, right? But even though, but it's not between Israelis and Palestinians, between Muslims and Christians or Jews. It is between those who support genocide and those who do not. Those who support a new community to emerge and those who do not. Those who are able, capable, and courageous enough to try to fashion and shape the new future, the coming years, and those who think that they cannot. There are so many people who feel that they cannot do things. And there are so many people who feel that they can. We here are part of that group that is saying that we need to actually participate in the making of the new future. How do we do that in Wisconsin? How do we do that? I mean, we cannot do that in isolation. So, for example, decolonization has to start here. Decolonization means Ho-Chunk Nation should be repatriated as much as possible every single day that we make decisions. It should be, the decisions should be made according to an ethical standing that says indigenous populations should get back whatever that was stolen from them. I don't know how, I don't know when, I don't know, and I disagree with Elena. She said that it's probably not possible. I think it is possible. And that you might come back and celebrate the land here. And this is coming to you from a Palestinian who is being decimated now, right? There is always hope. There is always a chance. And we can determine it because that's us. We are the people who can shape things. Of course, the forces against us and against the people who think with love and compassion and relations and try to figure out a new way of kinship that doesn't depend on economic and technical kind of relations, but it becomes relations of compassion and love. We have to do that. I mean, there is no way that we, and I mean, I believe that, I mean, I renewed my belief. Of course, I stopped and became dormant for a while, but I renewed my belief that it's not a goal, that liberation is not really a goal. Liberation is a process. Liberation is today. Liberation is in every act that one can do or does. That's what liberation is. It's the moment that we are here. We are acting in liberty. We are taking command. We are commanding our present. We are re-understanding our past, and we are reflecting on our future. So we are doing it, right? So it's not like, I mean, I don't think, for example, with Palestinian suffering, which is huge. I mean, the trauma is unbelievable. Elena, I have no idea how you deal with it. I really don't. I mean, it's even your trauma is way longer than ours and probably more extreme because at least we are still like in the middle of whatever that they think it's a fight, right? But I mean, even in the midst of this trauma, I still think that it's not possible, or at least I cannot accept the notion that imperialism or militarism or ecocide, ecological killing, basically, that that's a foregone future. It's still coming, but we have in our hands the possibility, the ability and the responsibility to fashion a new future and to take it out of this capitalist, militarist, and imperialist relations that were forced on all of us. Anyway, I want to finish with highlighting one thing. In northern Gaza, there is a refugee camp that's called Jabalia. In the last 2 days, the Israeli forces have been adamant on finishing northern Gaza. Somehow, there is something that's cooking up in their imagination and probably in conjunction with the U.S., but there is something cooking up where they want to clear northern Gaza. Northern Gaza is the part that was subject to the most violent attacks, right? That's the part where they asked people to vacate long ago in the beginning of the war. However, the people of Jabalia and people in the north stayed. Many of them rejected the orders to evacuate. And there are about 250 or 300,000 of them still there. And now the Israelis decided the order, they just again ordered them that they have to evacuate. And they said, no food, no water, if you decide to stay. And at the same time, they started a huge campaign of carpet bombing every single place. Like, I mean, we're saying, you know, imagine that I'm saying that this is worse than what happened in the last 12 months, right? It's unbelievable, the atrocities that are happening. So please keep them in your mind. Whatever you're doing, try to investigate what's happening there. There are a couple of Palestinian journalists there who are reporting from there. Follow them, follow the news on Jabalia, and keep it up in your social media, in your conversations, because they are adamant at reducing it to an inhabitable place. I mean, we already in Gaza, there were 90,000 tons of explosives. Do you know how many Hiroshima's bombs these are? Six. Six bombs of Hiroshima kind of style have been thrown on Gaza, on that population. So please keep them in your mind. And, you know, I hope we can continue. I promise that I will continue my activism with also Native Americans and with people of color all over, with people who need rent, who lack housing, who are poor, who are unable to meet the challenges of this atrocious, capitalist, violent police state. We need to keep working for them. And I think many of us have much more kind of, we have a place, a position where we can speak from that might actually uplift certain people, which you did with me, right? And thank you. I thank you for that. You uplifted the Palestinian issue. God knows what attacks you will be subjecting yourselves to in the coming weeks, but but you're used to that. I think you're uplifting me, but I really ask and beg that we keep Palestinians, but not only Palestinians, people in the Congo, for example, that suffering, people in the Sudan, that suffering is unbelievable. We are kind of, as a U.S.-centered people, we are the beneficiaries of all these wars. We really are. Not everybody in the U.S., of course. I mean, some of us are beneficiaries of those wars. And we have to start, like, put our foot down as citizens to tell them, no, stop. And we will not allow that. But thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
That was Professor Samer Alatoot, and he and the other two speakers are linked on the northernspiritradio.org website, as is the WNPJ.org site, where you can see videos of the speakers and much more. I hope these speakers fired up you for your work for peace and justice, and I hope you'll join us again next week for Spirit in Action. The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, Thank you.